From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, The Supernatural and Harry Houdini. Lots going on. Here's what's happening. What a tragic story in Indiana. An Indiana boy is recovering after a very mysterious illness forced doctors to amputate the lower half of all four of this little boy's limbs. While his family dealt with the news, the mother was about to deliver his baby sister. The two-year-old, Jeremiah, began running a fever in late September. His family had been playing at a park the day before. His mother had gone on maternity leave from her job when he began running a fever. While the parents brought him to a hospital, and his health rapidly declined to the point where they had to remove his limbs. Very bizarre story, folks. Well, the plane behind the Lion Air's crash off of Indonesia was one of the Boeing's newest and most advanced jets. It was just 2 months old with 800 hours under its belt, so experts are baffled as to what exactly caused the 737 MAX 8 to simply crash with 189 people aboard, all presumed still dead. Infamous Boston mob killer James Whitey Bulger is dead. He was beaten to death in his prison cell in West Virginia, where he was just transferred there. He was 89 years old. He was found unresponsive. Now, they think the inmates had potential mob ties as well. Now, Whitey, of course, was a fugitive for 16 years, was sentenced in 2013 to life in prison after being convicted of several crimes, including racketeering, money laundering, and murder. The jury believed he took part in 11 of 19 killings. Johnny Depp played him in a movie. Surveys show economically that consumers have been this confident only twice before, at the height of the economic booms of the 60s and 90s, and their mood is bright across all income groups, not just among the rich. What's going on? Let's check in with Catherine Austin Fitz. Catherine, why this euphoria about the economy?
Well, we've repatriated a huge amount of capital. We have very strong fiscal stimulus. And, you know, that means a lot of money is coming back, including, George, the fact that much manufacturing that we sent abroad is now can be brought back, and that's in part thanks to robotics and new technology. So the U.S. is the bright spot right now in the global economy. And the question is, if the rest of the world doesn't join us there, you know, will that drag us back down? But for now, the U.S. is strong. Another question on the sort of horizon is, it's dependent on an enormous fiscal stimulus, and the deficit is rising tremendously, and I doubt we can keep that going. So hopefully this repatriation of capital will kick in.
What's Catherine's predictions for 2019?
Oh, George, I think we're going to have a very strange year.
I think so too, Catherine.
You know, if you take a look at what AI is doing to the economy, it's really changing, and it can change very rapidly because it's, you know, software can move very quickly on the digital systems, and I think we're accelerating into a period of the kind of change we haven't seen since the Reformation. I mean, somebody said to me, this is the 13th century all over again, but artificial intelligence and robotics are going to bring tremendous change.
Go to Catherine's website, solari.com, S-O-L-A-R-I, and she also puts together an amazing newsletter. NASA's Parker Solar Probe is now closer to the sun than any other spacecraft in history, shattering the previous record of 26.6 million miles set by the Helios 2 spacecraft back in 1976. The probe is now well inside the orbit of Mercury to study the sun. A bizarre series of images show what looks like a giant plume of smoke stretching 900 miles over the surface of Mars. Despite fire being impossible on the red planet, astronomers have been watching the curious cloud for more than a month now through pictures beamed back from a European probe. We've got that story for you in our highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com. Mike Bearer, of course, author of Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA, with us. Mike, what do you think's going on Mars? What is that?
Well, actually, George, I'm pretty convinced it's got to be volcanic activity, no matter what NASA says, because the bottom line is they're saying it's water vapor, but it's, you know, it's late fall going into winter on Mars, and I can't see how water vapor rising out of a hole would create this plume that would be over 930 miles long at its peak during the day and last, you know, for a long time and long enough to be photographed. And there's also the fact that it's right next to Arisa Mons, which is one of the largest, three largest volcanoes on Mars. And that, to me, indicates that it's volcanic, or there could be some other source, which is, you know, even crazier. What if there's, you know, what if it's the Krell down there from Forbidden Planet with the nuclear reactors? Maybe one of their reactors went bad. I don't know, but it's definitely not water vapor, as NASA claims.
I thought, Mike, Mars was a dead planet.
That's what they keep telling us, but, you know, the truth is we don't know. There's no way for us to find out because we don't really have any seismometers there. We dropped a couple seismometers down with the Viking probes, but they're out of commission. They've long since been out of commission. And we do have the InSight probe going to Mars, but it doesn't launch for another month or so, and it'll take a year or two to get there. So we don't have any way of knowing if there's volcanic activity taking place on Mars right now. And I'm not sure, given the fact that NASA's photos of the same area don't seem to show this plume, or at least they didn't until a couple of days ago. I don't know that they tell us the truth, even if they found it. I think they want us to believe that Mars is a dead planet, but I don't think it is.
What a great story. Mike's website, Mike Barra, BARA.com, his name. Thanks, Michael. Appreciate it. Up next, how people have used technology in an effort to search for immortality. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. It's called Strange Frequencies, the extraordinary story of the technological quest for the supernatural by Peter Biebergall. He writes widely on the speculative and slightly fringe side. His essays and reviews have appeared in the NewYorker.com, the Times Literary Supplement, Boing Boing, The Believer, and Quietus. He's the author of The Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll, Too Much to Dream, A Psychedelic American Boyhood, and The Faith Between Us, and, of course, Strange Frequencies. Peter, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Lots going on these days. Happy Halloween, too, by the way.
Thank you. Yes, perfect timing.
If we have time, I want to talk with you a little bit about Season of the Witch, but this is an incredible story, Strange Frequencies. How did you come upon this?
Well, it's always been an interest of mine. I mean, I grew up, you know, watching the shows probably that you loved also, In Search Of, and I watched Creature Double Feature, of course, in the morning, and I just always loved those stories, and I particularly loved how this interaction of technology always seemed to play an important part of it, especially in the 70s and the 80s, and I think it was the film Poltergeist that really had an impact on me, given that the way that the spirits made their way into this suburban home was through the television set.
Technology at its best.
Always something. That's right. That was just always something that was sort of part of my way of thinking about things. And then I met a photographer named Shannon Taggart, and she's someone who photographs mediums, particularly at Lilydale in upstate New York.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at her photographs of mediums in trance states and the phenomena that she was able to capture really made me want to investigate the entire history of all the various ways people have tried to use new technologies, from the camera to the radio, to try to interact with a spiritual reality. Not always spirits, wasn't always spirits, but there's always been some connection between some inventive process of the human thing that we're trying to interact with the world and how we use technology to wrestle with some of the bigger questions.
And with this kind of technology, as it continues, Peter, to get better and better and better, are we going to find out more things about the supernatural side of the world?
Well, I think it's going to give us more opportunities to spark that part of our imagination, for sure. Do you know that when you try to log into a website and you get that little thing called a CAPTCHA code,
yep,
where you have to write in a little. So I know a woman who actually uses the CAPTCHA code as a kind of Ouija board, where she'll write down what the word is, and instead of entering it in, she'll refresh the page to get a new word. And she'll keep refreshing the page over and over again until all the words render into some sentence.
Why do they do the caption? Just to make sure you're a real person?
Exactly, so they know you're not a bot, as it were.
Well, it happens with technology. You know, I'm also fascinated. I don't know if you've looked at EVPs, electronic voice phenomena, where...
Yeah, there's a whole chapter in the book about that.
Perfect, perfect. Because it seems to me that since we've gone to the digital age from the analog age, they're getting more and more of these recordings.
Yes, indeed. And I think that what you have is you have the ability now to use digital radios to scan the frequencies more quickly. A fellow by the name of Frank Sumption in the 90s figured out that if you hack a digital FM radio, you can literally break it in such a way so that as it scans the frequencies, it doesn't stop at a station. When the signal comes in clear, it just continually sweeps. And again, that continuous sweeping has, if you do that, voices and other sounds sort of arise out of that noise. And again, people will write these words down that they will capture in these very quick, sparse moments as it scans the frequencies and see if they can have some or attempt to have some kind of communication with what they imagine as the spirit world.
He came up with what is called Frank's Box, which is
trying to do
exactly that, isn't it?
That's right, Frank's Box. And you can see some of the photographs online of these really wonderful, very creative devices that he made. And they became more and more complex till eventually he started to think that maybe, in fact, it wasn't spirits at all, but that he was communicating with extraterrestrials.
Peter, as you were putting together Strange Frequencies, did you come across anything strange yourself?
Well, I did some experiments, and there were a few times where there were a few things that I thought were particularly odd. But I think what was important was that I was able to sort of get into that headspace where I felt that I was doing something that had been being done for centuries. I mean, I would like to make the argument that even somebody like John Dee, who was using his seeing stones to try to communicate with the angels and as a result created what magicians call the Enochian language, that use of a seeing stone is the same as using a radio to communicate with the spirit world. That this is something that human beings have been attempting to do with some mediumistic device, some material device, where we take something and we repurpose it. We use it in a way that it wasn't originally intended. And in fact, the magician or the medium becomes a kind of spiritual hacker, where we're really trying to interact with our technologies and our material world in a way that some would say really isn't what we're supposed to be doing with it. And yet, as we know, it's really the hackers that were early on the most inventive. And if it wasn't for the hackers, we probably wouldn't have desktop computers today in our home.
That's true. Peter Bibigal with us. His latest book is called Strange Frequencies. You start the book with Jewish mythology and legends surrounding the golem. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, I like to think that the golem is really the first piece of technology, right, where we try to build something and imbue it with a spiritual power and use it to some end. What's interesting about the golem legend is the legend of the golem, as it's called, particularly the Golem of Prague, is a story of a rabbi who builds a golem to help the Jewish people who feel who are being attacked, or there's a pogrom and they're trying to defend themselves. And eventually the golem there's chaos ensues. The rabbi can no longer control it, and he either has to destroy it or he has to put it to sleep. In one of the stories, the golem grows so large that the rabbi has to climb up on a ladder and erase the secret word from its forehead, and it crumbles into dust, sometimes crushing the rabbi in some of the stories. But if you look at the actual Jewish Kabbalistic mystical writings about the golem is in some ways a means by which the rabbi demonstrates their spiritual acumen. It's almost like a test to show that they are prepared for greater mystical and magical knowledge. But the golem itself was understood by the rabbis to be just kind of a dumb machine. There's a wonderful Talmudic story where a rabbi go to the head rabbi and they show him the golem, and he says to them, well, what can it do? Can it speak? And they say, well, no, it can't speak. And he says, well, then what good is it? It's just a toy. Speech is what really makes the human being different from all the other creatures.
That's right.
And so if we can't do that, we're not playing God. We might think we are, but if we can't do that, then we're just pretenders to the throne, as it were.
Peter, what about the shamans as well? You know, in Native American tradition and other types of cultures, the shaman also seemed to be the person connected to the other side.
That's right. And the shaman would also use and utilize sound and light often and other kinds of mechanisms to try to induce these states of consciousness in their people. And I think that what the shaman does and what the stage magician does in many ways is very connected. And it also connects us and connects the technology to the history of spiritualism and the staging of spiritualism with spirit cabinets and the different ways in which people were using technologies. Sometimes it was just a little lever inside the cabinet, but they were using technologies to be able to create these states of consciousness in the audience. And so I don't think that it's necessarily, when we don't go to see a magic trick and get mad that we're being tricked, right? We want to be enchanted. We want to exist in that state of mind. And so all the ways in which people have used technology, whether it's very primitive or very advanced, I think is something that we've long been excited about. I mean, even watching a film about spirits in the movie theater is almost like a shamanistic experience, isn't it?
Thomas Edison, the great inventor, was obsessed with trying to communicate with the other side. He tried to build his own machine. I don't think he was ever able to do it, was he?
No, and in fact, you know, he really wanted it to be true. And this even goes back to the ways in which we have very interesting thing here, where we have people who are considered scientists and rationalists. And it's not that they were debunking because they wanted to just be cynical or skeptical. It's because they really wanted there to be this truth. This is true of Houdini. Houdini really wanted he really wanted to find a medium who could communicate with the other side so that he might speak with his dearly departed mother. But he couldn't find one. All he found were charlatans. But he believed that it could be possible. And I think that that's an important thing, that sometimes we lose a sense of that mystery in our lives, where let's just for a moment pretend, even if it's just a pretend moment, imagine that these things could be possible. And I think that that's a valuable place to sometimes just sit still for a while with ourselves.
And Houdini, by the way, you're right, was obsessed with trying to find out about the other side. We're talking about him in a couple hours after we're done talking to you,
Peter. Oh, that's right. Yes, that's right.
It's going to be exciting. He was one heck of a guy, but as you say, he wasn't able to find the medium to do the job.
That's right.
If he had today's equipment, do you think he might be able to do something?
Maybe, but I think that he would also find, which unfortunately I sometimes found, is that people were using these things. But if you sort of, move the curtain aside, you saw the Wizard of Oz there with all his contraptions and gizmos,
mm-hmm.
quickly trying to hide the fact that maybe he really wasn't as magical as you had thought.
We're going to be back in a moment. More with Peter Biebergall, his book, Strange Frequencies. We've got a link to his publisher, Random House, to make it easy for you to get the book. If you're into this, it's a magnificent story. The subtitle is The Extraordinary Story of the Technological Quest for the Supernatural. So stick with us. We're going to take calls with Peter next hour. We'll even take your stories, your paranormal stories, and just your general questions. More to talk with him about, though, about strange frequencies, high technology, and its ability to maybe communicate with the other side. The return to Everett, Washington, the historic Everett Theater, Saturday, March 23rd. We're going back for our live stage show and meet and greet with special guests, and we're just going to have a great time, and tickets are clicking along. And if you're out there in that area, or if you're going to visit Everett, Washington, pick them up right now. Go to events at coasttocoastam.com. It's at the top of the homepage. You'll see that. Or click the revolving carousel picture of the event, the live stage show. It'll take you straight to the historic Everett Theater's website, and you can get your tickets that way. If for some reason you're not computer savvy, here's a toll-free number for you, 425-258-6766. That's 425-258-6766. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Peter Biebergall with us, his latest book, Strange Frequencies, and we'll take your calls with Peter next hour here, so get ready for that. Peter, of all these incredible inventors and engineers and seekers who are attempting to get some kind of evidence about the existence of the other side, what do you think drove them? Why were they so obsessed with trying to get these answers?
I think what drives that quest is what drives a very human quest to take control of our own spiritual, material destinies. I mean, I think it's actually a very American spirit, right? I mean, some scholars, sociologists, one in particular, Max Weber, used to talk about, you know, Protestantism and the spirit of capitalism, that something about the Protestant American spirit is something whereby we want to prove our righteousness. We want to prove that we are loved by God by being successful in the world, by being innovators, inventors, entrepreneurs, right? And I think that that extends even to our sense of our own spirituality, and that this idea that we are in charge of our own salvation, where we want to be right in front of our experience with the divine, is again something that's very human, I think particularly American often. And so you have these people who are just doing what we've always wanted to do, which is to say, you know what, I'm going to do it. I'm going to figure out how to interact with the spirit or with God or divine or whatever. And how do we do that? Well, we often do that by inventing something, by making something, by taking something that pre-exists and opening it up and repurposing it. And so I think that that drive is a very human drive. It's why people have practiced magic for millennium, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just another example of magic, of a cult practice where we are trying to insert ourselves between, right in the middle, to get right in there and to say, I want to have this experience directly. I don't want it to be mediated, but if it is going to be mediated, I'm going to be the one who uses that tool, right?
Could we put you, Peter, in that category?
Myself?
Yeah.
Well, I definitely am somebody who believes in a spiritual reality and who wants to interact with that. I tend to believe, though, that we have to be careful about how much we try to wrest that, you know, from it. That we have to, let's put it this way, we have to meet God halfway, right? We can't make it all the way, you know? And if we get so far and we don't get an answer, then maybe there wasn't an answer at that moment for us to get.
Why does it seem that some people get the answer, or at least they think they do, and then others can't even get close?
Yeah, I mean, that's the greatest mystery, though, isn't it?
It sure is.
You know, why some people seem to be more sensitive to this, or why some people are. But this goes, you know, back to the whole idea that we once used to think that a prophet was somebody who had special information for us. And now we often believe that those people might actually be crazy, right? So, you know, for a long time, we've been wrestling with the visionary experience. And that's why, you know, even people who produce art that we call visionary art or spiritual art are often considered outsider artists. Why is that? Why are the people who are working with these themes considered to be outside artists as opposed to just people who are part of a regular, you know, mainstream artistic community? And I think it's, we live in a world where we still feel that these questions have to be a little bit on the outside of our normal experience. And what's interesting about technology is that, and this is really key here, if to see if I can explain this. Somebody takes a radio and they say, I'm gonna open up this radio and I'm gonna resolder a few connections to see if I can communicate with the spirit world. But the science that made that radio possible and the science that makes it possible to desolder it and have another effect take place, the science behind that that even made this radio something that you could buy in the store would say the communication with the spirit world is not possible. The spirits don't exist. And yet we can take the thing, this technology, and somehow divorce it from the science that is underneath it, the scientific method and scientific understanding of the world that's underneath it, and divorce it and turn it into a tool that we can use to try to have these experiences. And so I think there's a fascinating disconnect there about how we can think about technologies in ways that the science connected to them might actually be in opposition to.
Well, if you didn't own a radio or have a computer where you could listen online, and somebody came up to you and said, Peter, I hear voices of this guy at night talking about ghosts and spirits and all these strange things. He's out there. And you, of course, who never had a radio, you never went online like that to listen, you're probably saying, what's this guy talking about? He's insane. But my voice is out there. It's being heard by millions if they have the receiver to pick it up. And I think all we need in order to pick up the spirit world, which is all energy too, is the right kind of receiver.
Well, it's fascinating that you say that, because when spiritualism was becoming very popular in the 1800s, in the mid to late 1800s, it was also when we had started to develop telegraph technology. And people called mediums, spiritual mediums, spiritual telegraphs, because they really believed that there was this link between this new burgeoning technology and how, you're right, it was a special and new kind of receiver and transmitter, and that the human being could also be this thing. And so we use that same language to talk about them.
You say that being from the television era has really augmented and shaped things for spirituality and technology. Tell me why.
Well, I mean, the TV itself is kind of a very strange and mysterious.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's a very wonderful advertisement from a television set in 1934 called the Plu Television Company. And they actually, this is how they advertised their television. This is what they said. The dreams of witches have come true.
Oh, my God.
So they saw this thing, this new device, that the way to capture the public's imagination about buying this thing was not to try to make it less weird, but to increase its sense of being connected to some supernatural dream that we once had, that we could communicate in this way over the ether, right? And so the fact that, you know, we used to call those the after effects on a TV, you know, used to watch UHF and VHF stations with an antenna, we used to call those ghosts, right? So even the way in which we think about the television metaphorically is filled to the brim, right, with these supernatural and occult metaphors. And I think that that's really important. I think that even when we talk about technology, even if we're not believers in it, even if we're just using it, we still use this language to try to make sense of it.
And I remember those days, too, not that this has anything to do with our discussion tonight.
That's okay.
But radios and televisions were built into very heavy furniture. Remember those?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
My dad used to have an old Philco radio, and this thing must have been about 4 feet tall. And, you know, it was encased in this beautiful piece of wooden furniture and had Philco written across it. It was a piece of art. And the same with the TVs and the stereos that they started coming out with.
That's right. These are meant to be centerpieces of our home, right? And so you can imagine this thing, the centerpiece of our home, and then a movie like Poltergeist comes out, it only makes sense that this is how the spirits would come into our lives, is through the TV.
Are you 100% convinced, Peter, that the other side exists?
I'm not 100% convinced about anything. So I, I live in a very liminal place. What I like more than anything, and what I like about this, about technology, is that I really believe that these ambiguous states are enchanting states. That when somebody tries to convince me something is 100% true, I tend to be a lot more skeptical than somebody who just wants to share an interesting experience with me.
Get into your time machine and tell me what you think things will be like 50 years from now with regards to trying to communicate with the other side.
Yeah. Well, let's talk more about maybe it's not that we will communicate with the other side, but that we will have transcended to the other side by use of artificial intelligence, uploading our consciousness to computers. There's a movement of what's called transhumanism and posthumanists who believe that we will become so merged with technology that we will become the new spirit world, that it's going to be our consciousness inhabiting this electronic digital realm. So I'm more convinced that it's going to be that we ourselves will become transcended via this technology.
So I've got a strange thought that when one sleeps outside of remembering a dream, you're basically dead. It's gone. It's over. Your life is not really functioning. You're out of it. Everything's void. And assuming you don't wake up, it's over for you. I sometimes think of the sleep state as the dying process. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, do you know the author, of course, Franz Kafka, right, who wrote
Yes.
The Metamorphosis? He once wrote that waking up from sleep is the most dangerous psychological moment in our lives, because we really are moving from these one almost completely different realms to the other, and it's extremely precarious. And yet somehow, like you say, we open our eyes from an almost death-like state. And imagine what our brain has to do in that moment to make everything come back to the way that we can understand it again in a split second of opening our eyes.
You tried to build your own golem. What happened?
Well, I realized that there was no way I was going to be able to memorize and then recite the 48,000 Hebrew words that were going to be required for me to meditate and fast while I did it. So I realized that I just was not either spiritually or, well enough versed
sure.
to be able to do it.
And you forget one verse, the whole thing won't work, I guess.
That's exactly right. Or you could set off a chain of things that maybe were not what you intended.
When you were putting together the book and you were researching the book, what were some of your most memorable paranormal experiences?
Yeah, I think, I went to Lilydale, like I said, in upstate New York with the photographer Shannon Taggart, and I went to a seance with her on the outskirts of Lilydale, where she was given permission to take photographs of a medium who was producing ectoplasm. And so for the first time in my life, I got to be in a classic, almost Victorian-like seance where the medium extruded ectoplasm, or what appeared to be ectoplasm, from their mouth. So that was quite an experience, I have to say.
And they had the lights out, correct?
The lights were completely out until that time, and then there was a very small tea candle that was lit so that at least you could see that.
Did they search you or check you before you all went into the seance area?
Oh, my gosh, you would not believe it. It was like going to visit somebody in prison.
Yes.
You had to give over your wallet and your keys and your phone, and there were all these instructions about how you could behave. If you felt something touch you, you should not reach out to try to touch it back. If you feel something move across, don't interact with it. And the way that they would describe it was that it was dangerous for the medium to do something like
that. Something could happen because of the ectoplasm, and if a light popped up, the medium could literally die or something.
That's exactly what they would warn. And so, he was also, before, he was blindfolded and gagged inside his spirit cabinet, and And then the spirits, or how he demonstrated it, you know, they opened the cabinet, and then he's no longer bound, so that his hands could pull the ectoplasmic material from his mouth. It was a very interesting, and, you know, the history of photographing ectoplasm goes back, you know, to the very beginning of the 20th century. And there are some beautiful photographs that your viewers can look up if they look up, you know, early ectoplasm photographs that they can see. But what's funny is some of them don't look very convincing, let's say.
Right, right. Now,
and so yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, but so the fellow who, this guy named Notzing, the fellow who was originally had taken these photographs, he said that actually in this case, the photography was doing a disservice to the experience. See, before him, spiritualists are very excited about this idea that you could photograph spirits. And what was important about that was that it was as if the spirits had been waiting for us to invent the camera so that they could make themselves known, that they had sort of been waiting for this moment. And once we invented the camera, they could then appear in a way that they couldn't before, because they needed this technology to do this. With the ectoplasm, though, Notzing felt that, in fact, the camera was doing a disservice to the actual experience of witnessing ectoplasm during a seance, and so he wanted to stop using the camera. So there's a very interesting contradiction there between, do we need the camera for the spirits to reveal themselves, or is it actually getting in the way of the experience?
Was the medium who was spitting out the ectoplasm under your seance, did he make a weird sound when he was doing it?
Yes. Yeah, so he, you know, first he was like, you know, almost like he was choking.
Like something like that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
We might have had the same person.
Yeah, extruding, you know, pulling it almost like, it reminded me a little bit of, you know, when you would see those magic tricks of the person pulling the scarf, you know, out over and over, because there was so much of it. You wonder, how could he possibly have kept this all in his mouth?
Exactly.
This was really, you know, that kind of thing.
Did they make everybody in the seance pitch black hold hands, too?
Yeah, I think there were some times when we had to. There was also a lot of music that was played.
Yeah, same with us. I'll tell you the thing which kind of baffled me, Peter, at the end, it's pitch black. You can't see anything. You're holding hands with everybody, so nobody has broken free or did anything. The medium, who apparently had the spirit in the room, okay, the spirit somehow knocked over a mic stand that we didn't know was there, and that shattered the whole event for me.
See, it really, exactly. There was an experience that I had similarly where he showed you at the beginning everything that you are supposed to know that he has access to. Like there was a drum and a trumpet and things like that that the spirits might have, levitate.
Right? Yes.
So you only saw those things. And then at one point during the seance, you hear what sounds like a whistle, like a slide whistle.
And you go, where did that come from?
Where did that come from? But then at the end of the seance, the slide whistle was visible.
And was the medium tied up to a chair?
Yes. Yep.
God, it's very similar to what I went through. Stay with us, Peter. We're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk more. Plus, we'll open up the phone lines. Questions, stories about the other side.